you're all too, and you know you've seen it all. And out of Scotland, and you'll go far back east to time, don't crawl. Play ethnic jazz to parade your snares on your bogged stereo. Bragging that you know how the niggas feel cold and the sun's got so much so. It's time to taste what you roast beer. Right, God will not help you here. Brace yourself, my dear. Brace yourself, my dear. It's a holiday in Cambodia. It's tough kid, but it's alive. It's a holiday in Cambodia. Don't forget to pack a wife. Speech. You suck like a leech, you want everyone to act like you. Kiss ass while you bitch so you can get rich, but your boss can switch her off you. Well, you'll work harder with a gun in your back for a bowl of rice a day. Slave or soldiers till you starve and your head is skewered on a steak. Now you can go where people are one. Now you can go where they get things done. What you need, my son? What you need, my son? It's a holiday in Cambodia where people dress in black. Need a holiday in Cambodia where no kids ask for crack.
Welcome to FSK 93.0. Ich bin ein Hamburger, a very special edition of Ich bin ein Hamburger, a bit different. We are actually this month not coming to you from Hamburg. We are Ich bin ein Hamburgers in Cambodia, in remote northeast of Cambodia. I'm here with our special guest, Dustin.
Greetings, happy to be on the show again. It's been a full year since my last appearance.
A bit over a year. Yeah. 13 months, yes. I was just reminded. And
the Valentine's special.
Yeah. But yes, we have... So we got the normal crew are unavailable, and I have come all the way here. I am what you call a COVID coward. Fleeing from the third lockdown of Hamburg, or a pandemic pariah. It's another term.
I thought you were a COVID cowboy.
My other friends have referred to me a fucker. So, yes, but yeah, we're in a place called Ratnakiri in the northeast of Cambodia. How would you describe Ratnakiri, Dustin?
It is mountainous. Small mountains, but big by Cambodian standards. Lush, green, rich, red dirt, peaceful, tranquil, and a lovely escape from city life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're in an eco lodge setup with all these kind of very like homemade huts kind of set up with no aircon, but still lovely decorated inside. And because you can't get into, it's difficult to get into Cambodia now as tourists, so a lot of the hotels are pretty empty. So we're alone in this hotel.
Private residence.
Private.
If you ever make it this way, Treetop Lodge.
Treetop Lodge
is the place.
Is the sponsor, official sponsor of
it
this.
It is stunning.
Of this show.
Apparently, if we mention it enough on this show, we'll get a discount from $12 a night to maybe $11.
Mm-hmm. And a free coffee. One of our 13 coffees that we order.
$12 a night on coffee and about $6 a night on coffee.
Mm-hmm. A lot of coffee. But yeah, so Cambodia, so it's a little bit better than Germany. So we got the stats today. So for Germany, it's 17,485 cases, and Cambodia 27 in the whole country. So what do you think? What do you think is the difference? Why do you have the impression, Dustin, that the cases are so low?
Well, a number of factors. Yeah. I think that Cambodia closing its border quite early on definitely helped reduce the movement of people.
Mm-hmm.
The government, for all its flaws, of which there are many flaws, was actually okay at instituting a few different rules early on. But I think a lot of it was really people being so scared of the virus and the fact that the health system is not particularly strong, that people kept distance very early on, wore masks universally. And the country, it's amazing, the country never actually locked down. Even at the peaks last year of March, April, people just voluntarily stayed home, shops mm-hmm. voluntarily closed. So I think a lot of these steps that people took upon themselves were highly effective in reducing. And there's also probably cultural aspects as well, that there's less physical intimacy amongst friends and family, which kind of reduces. And
not the hugging and the kissing.
Exactly.
It's just you do the polite prayer hands.
Yeah.
On greeting and yeah.
Yeah. And I think there is this sense of sacrificing some individual liberties for the greater good.
Okay. So more a collectivist mentality.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is interesting. I remember getting the flight over here and having the layover in Singapore. And Singapore has a very structured way of how you go through transit during COVID times. And it's very well organized. Everybody has X's to stand on, spaced out. You go in like a certain order. And this French guy was just berating the Singapore airline staff. Like, why are we doing this? This is ridiculous. And as the French guy left, I apologized on behalf of all the foreigners to this Singapore staff.
What was
person.
His problem? You just...
Yeah, I don't know what his problem was. It was an orderly process.
No one told him.
The Singapore staff member just laughed to me and said, "Oh no, don't worry. He can have his freedom and die. We're fine in Singapore. Like, we'll have rules and live." So, a lot of different factors.
I mean, they've only had that. So there was one outbreak caused by like a Hungarian.
November 3rd incident.
The November, they don't like naming names. They just go by the dates for these incidents. So there was a Hungarian like trade.
Yeah, foreign minister.
Okay.
November
3rd. And he shook the Prime Minister's hand. Didn't give it to the Prime Minister Hun Sen, but a few other government people, I think. But then they stamped that out.
November 28 incident.
What was that? What happened there?
Naming them after dates is really easy to remember. Mm. Another leak from quarantine. Again, got it under control. Early January, I was seeing live music in venues packed with hundreds of people,
mm-hmm.
and there were no cases. It wasn't until the February 20th incident.
Yeah. So this is just after... No, it's like on the day I arrived. No coincidence. Patient zero right here. I went through the, arrived, went through the quarantine process, went straight to the hotel. The magic bus takes you to a hotel where you don't know where you're going, and you stay there quarantined for 2 weeks, just trapped in the room, food delivered to the door. But yeah, this February 20 incident, so it would have been a similar setup for them, these guests that arrived. And then what happened after they...
So, there's not a clear story exactly.
okay,
it
okay,
is a bit
okay.
opaque, but definitely seems that four women escaped or bribed their way out of the quarantine, and they may have been involved in sex work, which, mm-hmm. if you look at the movement subsequently mapped out by the authorities, certainly conveys going to a lot of clubs and a lot of apartment buildings. Subsequently, they returned to quarantine and mm-hmm. then got their final test. So they'd kind of been... You have to get a test at the start and at the end of your quarantine.
That's
the,
right.
The test at the end was positive, and then it kind of came out that they had been circulating through Phnom Penh during that period. But then the cat was out of the COVID bag. And it was spreading.
And they arrived by private jet. That's confirmed.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And then they're due for harsh punishments, but when you're at the elite end of their industry and getting flown in by private jet, you also get flown out by private jet very quickly.
You must be pretty talented. I mean, any job where you get flown in by private jet, you got to be in that upper echelon. So they really have to be, yeah, top quality, yeah.
Skilled migrants, mm-hmm. for sure.
And then, so since then, it's stayed, or at least at the start, it stayed within this Chinese community in Phnom Penh as well. But then they don't really know. It slowly has got more Cambodians have been
Ones
affected.
So that's it. But even you see now, there's no lockdown at all, but people are encouraged to stay home. Everybody's wearing a mask. Like, even I remember going out for lunch and when it was being announced, all these new activities, and then on the way to riding my bike to lunch, not many people wearing masks. On the way riding back from lunch, all of a sudden everybody's wearing masks. So people are very, very quick to adopt the different measures.
Yeah. And there's two other conspiracy theories that people have told me. One is that because Cambodians, Khmers, have been consuming bat for such a long period of time, that they have developed immunity or have these antibodies just from bat consumption. Do you think that's reasonable?
I've heard that theory. Maybe not as much from consumption, but from like...
Or exposure.
Exposure, yeah.
To bat droppings.
Yeah,
and
things like that. There's maybe some validity to that, but mm-hmm. my background is not very scientific.
You don't have a background.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think it's an interesting theory. Yeah, it's the old horseshoe bats, I believe.
Because I believe in Bat and Bung, the market there is covered in bat droppings.
Yeah.
And if you like walk slightly outside the market, you often get hit in the head by either bat urine or bat feces.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think there's certainly legitimacy, because also Thailand, Vietnam, Laos have all handled it pretty well, and they all have the same bat. Mm-hmm. But they've all done the same measures of closing borders.
And the mandatory quarantine.
Yeah, and yeah, basically did everything effectively that Europe and North America were incapable of.
I mean, people in Europe, when I tell them that, it's so low here, they often don't believe me because they don't trust governments here, which is fair enough. And they suggest that it's just the government manipulating these numbers. Do you think that's a reasonable theory as well?
I think at the start, there was definitely like a lack of testing. So a lot of the numbers, but that happened in every country throughout the world at the start. A lot of cases didn't get picked up because of lack of testing. But I was talking to a friend, particularly who his wife works in the hospital system, is working on COVID things, and there hasn't been this like surge in people coming to hospital with respiratory illnesses.
Yeah, you notice in the hospitals huge number of
exactly
in the bodies and stuff.
So I think the numbers are pretty
pretty
legit, and the way they've subsequently responded when there's been small outbreaks in November and now. Seems to indicate they do take it seriously, and if it does exist, so.
And I feel like with social media, if it was obvious there was a lot of deaths, then a lot of that would go on social media, and I mean, they censor things, but Facebook is still pretty free, you would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
No, I'd say the numbers are pretty, like, overall case numbers may be a bit off, but yeah, the actual deaths, which is now ticked over to 5. Compared to 75,000 in Germany.
And then Yeah, and the demographics, I guess, are also helpful, right? That everyone's so young compared to, like, European countries. It's not much of a... So, yeah, you're saying that they're vaccinating all the people over, you know, 65 at the moment, and it's only taken a few weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's only, like, 8 people.
Yeah, it's phenomenal how quickly that'll get done. Yeah, and I think that's played out elsewhere in Africa as well, where you have a much younger population. So even, like, South Africa, there's been a lot of cases, but because of younger demographic, less vulnerable than the US and Europe, or even Latin America.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. All right, well, that's our COVID talk. We'll go for a song now, and then we'll come back and talk about more about politics in Southeast Asia.
This is where madmen, missionaries, relief workers, journalists, and backpackers and westerners come to behave badly.
Falling, spirit of Angkor calling, running, balling, opium balling, streets are seeing ream, barbecue smoke is sticky green, back at the bar it's Akbar, lost amidst the global slackers, whiskey and chang, I'm tipsy, then a panrong banger hits me, road of the ancients and fried spider, right where the old and the new collided, running amok with our luck just holding, racing through in a light that's golden, in the jungle beholden to unseen hands, twisted grin in a strange land, monkey business, glimpse of Hanuman, twisting the bush bud, whoosh, I'm hammered man, sin system with tune in the background, asleep in the back of the cab, but I'm coming round. Now we're getting towed through the campong. If it could have gone wrong, then it has gone wrong. Could give a damn. So hand me the papers. Stone reliefs touch inner spaces. Street scenes of dreams, we put a figurines line in the highway, dogs and hens, wide-eyed kids in the light that's heaven sent. Presently, these blasted gens might well be spent. Us class represent in our defenses. We open the third eye with six senses. Inventive and even-tempered, smiling, wryly Apache memories. Come on, dreaming of mythical entities. We just became reality's enemies. It was meant to be, made it eventually. Transported to the 13th century. Visions of Vishnu are sent to me as Kali whispers gently. Nagas twisting around the drama, dropped in a real-life Ramayana. Calmer than just before the dawn, speaking the words but not here at all. We're lost at a critical junction, functioning only just. Trust that we're dustier down the road home. For barangs in a tuk-tuk, we call that a wide load.
And welcome back, FSK 93.0 Ich bin ein Hamburger in Cambodia. So, yeah, like I said before, we are escapees from the third... A bit of random... Is that fruit?
Is it a coconut before? Or a mango or...
So yeah, we're in this eco lodge area, and so we're surrounded by a whole bunch of fruit trees. So like dragon fruit, pineapple, I don't know, like, yeah, coconuts, they are a risk. People do die, right? That's the genuine thing.
Yeah,
coconuts get hit under a coconut tree. It's not like the koala drop bear myth that some Germans do actually believe this.
Koala drop bears, yeah.
Yeah.
But not nearly as bad as the hoop snake rolling down the hills.
I don't know what's that.
Oh, it's the snakes that bite the end of their tail and form a hoop and then roll down the hills.
I see. Yeah. Sounds believable. The physics of that add up fine.
Did a lot of camping when I was young.
But yeah, so you can probably hear some nature in the background. So there's a combination of maybe insects, some dogs, animals, and also, like, I don't know if you can hear this slight buzzing of the chainsaw.
Yeah.
So this is an issue in Cambodia that they've spent, you know, post Khmer Rouge and everything, sort of rebuilt the country, but that's also involved a lot of, logging and destroying the kind of environment, because it's sort of adopted, you'd say, like a neoliberal method of development. Is that a fair?
Very. Very neoliberal model of development. But I think that also overlooks that or neoliberal market ideology is kind of used as a way to excuse the fact that you just have this elite cronies...
Mm-hmm. Crony capitalism.
...extracting as much as they possibly can out of the country with impunity and no accountability. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you can also get money from capitalist countries by saying... aid from capitalist countries by saying... look, we're doing the neoliberal market model like you asked. You know, support it. Give us some more money.
Yeah, in my current research, it's interesting that I haven't read a lot of constitutions around the world. The Cambodian constitution actually has written into it that it will be a market-based economy.
Interesting.
So it's actually ingrained into the constitution, the kind of economy. Yeah.
That's even more than... I don't think the US Constitution doesn't have anything like that.
No,
I don't believe. Yeah, that's crazy. So what, I mean, so the negatives of this has been like, yeah, all the corruption and all the, I guess, environmental destruction probably. Do you say there's any positive aspects that they've, of this crony, neoliberal system that they've set up?
No, not really. Short answer.
You have to fill time to...
Yeah, so let me elaborate. In Cambodia, no. I think in other countries historically, there's been some cases where the consolidation of capital to some cronies has worked out okay because the movement of capital between countries was quite limited and difficult. So as a crony elite accumulated money... they then reinvested it back into the country. And I think Japan, Taiwan, South Korea are all pretty good examples of that. But I think at the time, you know, from the 90s, where the Cambodian elite was able to accrue massive wealth, rather than that being a drive for further development in the country through investing it back into the country, they've been able to offshore a lot of that money and just kind of accumulate it and secure it in places where it can't be touched so easily.
Yeah.
So I don't think the benefit has been particularly good at all for Cambodia. If the elites, like the elites definitely invest some back into the country, but then also there's this crowding out of a lot of businesses because these elites control so much of the economy. So if you want to get into the banking sector or various other sectors, you need to like muscle in against all these cronies who have a lot of power, which is really difficult.
Like all the fast food chain licenses are all, they got in early, all these cronies, so there's all these random tycoons or military figures that own like KFC, Burger King. And there's still no McDonald's in Cambodia because, yeah, the guy that owns it is just like, nah, we'll have our own, you know, Lucky Burger chain and we'll, we won't bother with McDonald's. They just steal the colours and then, yeah, so it's, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, even like, yeah, stuff like Visa is owned by people linked to the ruling family and, yeah, it's pretty hard to escape. So it's interesting, like, you have this, like, framing of, like, neoliberal free market ideology, but it is very far removed from a free market. It is
yeah.
a heavily controlled market, just rather than a state-controlled market, it's a, an elite-controlled market.
Mm-hmm. But I always feel like Cambodia, in a way, is this sort of developing country, but I always sort of saw it as kind of the future of the West in a way, because they, I feel like they kind of leapfrogged a lot of the period of time when they were kind of, you know, not developing and leapfrogged to the next stage with it. I think this, this kind of elite cronyism where you don't have as much of this social mobility and people do get trapped in this, you know, working at a certain level and just wage earning and this gig economy thing. And never can get to a higher level of starting businesses and industries and stuff. So, you think that's fair, or am I pushing it too much with... Because the West now, it's like, because you have everything run, especially in, like, tech sector and stuff, it's just run by these, like, really big dominant industries that kind of decide the rules.
Yeah.
And then no one can really challenge them in their power, and I feel, I don't know, I get Cambodia vibes in there. Some of Western economy stuff.
Yeah, nowadays. I definitely agree with that. And there's been like a pretty systematic dismantling of the union movement in Cambodia and any kind of even agricultural cooperatives and things like that.
Yeah.
Attempts to kind of prevent any types of mass mobilization. And you also, yeah, the land is a particularly prominent area where there's a lot of consolidation of land ownership, and then people are getting kicked off their land or getting minimal compensation and then being re-employed back onto plantations.
Yeah, so it's not quite
slave labor, but it's pretty close to indentured labor and this whole kind of casualization or uberization of labor. Definitely.
Yeah, and that's connected, I think, to this microfinance sector of, you know, lending people bits of money which is claimed to be for business, but it's often for urgent expenses where they have nowhere else to turn, and, you know, grandmother is sick or whatever, and then borrow that money and then get into too much debt and then lose the land and then end up in these kind of wage jobs. So it's like, again, ways to marketize thing and make things seem like the market's fixing a problem where it's just putting people into sort of this servitude. Yeah, we're tea-toting socialists. Coffee-toting socialists? Is this
Yeah. Well, yeah. If we had a Chardonnay on hand, I'd be happy to be a Chardonnay socialist.
But yes. All right. Well, that's enough politics. We'll go to another song now, and then we'll come back and discuss a little bit of Cambodian culture. Okay, we're back again on Ich bin ein Hamburger in Cambodia on FSK 93.0 here with Dustin, a special guest. So Dustin is here, like I am here in Cambodia, because we both have a kind of history with Cambodia. We both used to live here, that's how we met each other.
Way back in 2010?
Yeah, 2010, yeah, so it's like our 11th year anniversary, so it's been a long time. I mean, I come back here regularly and he does as well. I mean, there's just something, I don't know, I find kind of addictive about Cambodian culture and stuff and where, like, can you put your finger on what is so attractive to you about?
Oh, many
it's to the list. I mean, for me, I find the people just very warm and friendly. Cambodians, just Khmer people, and like a good kind of sense of humor and kind of chilled out attitude to life. Like, as we said, the government are, you know, pretty, you know, not the nicest people in the world, but the general culture, underlying culture, is very friendly and
putting it mildly in terms of the government, but yeah. I think there's like sometimes a bit of barriers, but once you get to know people and the barriers go down, people are very welcoming and, you know, invite you back to their houses or families, or try to share a lot of Cambodian culture as well, which I really love. Yeah, like I have a lot of friends from back in 2010, maintain regular contact, so it's really nice being back now and being able to spend some time with those friends.
So go to their houses or, you know, karaoke and singing is a big deal in Cambodia, like a lot of Asian countries. They have this whole, I mean, it's not, I feel like it hasn't taken off yet in Germany, this concept of KTV or K-box kind of thing. But can you describe what's involved in this? What is a K-box?
Well,
KTV.
Yeah, KTV, karaoke is a fun time. Generally, yeah, a small room with a couple microphones and free-flowing beer, generally. Also, whiskey can be involved, but I've had the experience of once doing it sober straight after work as a team bonding thing, which
not
lasted
fun
for about 10 minutes, and then we're all like, okay, let's get as many beers into us as quickly as possible. Half an hour later, it was really fun.
Yeah. No, getting wasted is a big part.
Yeah, particularly when nobody's singing skills are really good. They definitely get better after a couple of drinks.
It's not so much singing as shouting into a microphone.
Yeah.
Multiple people.
Yeah, and it's fun when, because neither of us can read the Cambodian script, because it's very complicated. But ad-libbing or creating up your own kind of love songs, because Cambodian songs are very centered around love songs. So karaoke, it's always about love song.
It's love and drama. Mm. Often there's like things like revenge, like jealousy. Often cheating. These kind of
And the videos that go with the songs are
dramatic.
Fantastic. So if you can just make up your own song in Cambodian language, Khmer, and just talk about the love that you had, but it was too difficult because you're a foreigner and you can't understand each other. Seeing that in Khmer, people tend to love it, even though the actual words might be something totally different.
they'll give you points for trying.
Yeah.
One of my favorite ones is the English translation is called Love, I Have Nothing Right. And it's about a woman who turns alcoholic and gives up on the concept of men, because she's just like, nah, it just always falls through and they're all bastards, and she's like, my only friend is the drink. Is one of the lyrics.
I love it.
And the clip is also good. It's just her like smashing a lot of wine bottles, and I'd recommend this. And there's also Khmer dancing. This is very interesting as well. It's just very slow, because you have these kind of upbeat kind of songs, but everyone will just move.
Yeah, the wrist movements. Very
slow
cool
finger movements. Everyone has just the very bendy finger stuff. And then, very slow dancing. It kind of looks, when you see it, looks like an awkward kind of high school dance. Just like, yeah, at weddings and stuff. And Khmer weddings are very good. They're like, you have 3 days, 3 day long parties where, yeah, set up the big tents and have all these like regular meals. And you just kind of turn up to the wedding when you feel like it, rather than having like set times. It's just this kind of big party that's set up. This is the provincial ones. I think the city, yeah, they don't do as many like this anymore, but yeah, provincial one, you just pop in.
Yeah, and it's quite funny. There's a system for, you get an envelope when you come, and then you put your monetary contribution into the envelope and then give it back. But then, rather than it being an anonymous type thing, they record everybody's name and how much they donated. Yeah. And then it's expected at the next wedding, you go to somebody else's wedding, then you will give back the same amount they gave plus a little bit extra. Just really interesting system. But I think it works quite well.
It seems fair for
young people who can't afford a wedding. Often they end up getting a bit more money back from the weddings. Although a friend of mine, because there was a cancellation of weddings during COVID for a while, and then they recently restarted. Some of my friends are just going broke from going to wedding after wedding. Like, some of them get 2 or 3 weddings per week. And they're just exhausted. They're like so sick of going to weddings.
Oh, man.
And yeah, it's just money after money. But they're getting well fed.
How much, what do you usually put in for these weddings? What's the standard?
I've only been to one since I came back, and I had no idea who the person was. It was just on a work trip. Mm-hmm. So I put in $10.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. I figured it was enough to kind of cover the meal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's funny, they started writing down my details, and I was like, oh, don't worry about it. Like, I'm never going to see you again. You're probably not going to come to my wedding if I ever have one, so don't worry.
But maybe you're giving, like, the expat, you're setting this, I don't know. How much do you like expats, you know, I don't know, reflection, I don't know.
Yeah, I tried to show my student ID as well.
Do you take the international student card? Discount. And how does it compare? All right, so the other backstory to Dustin is he also spent a lot of time in Myanmar, also known as Burma. I don't know, why do they still have to say that? Is there a point at which they will stop saying also known as Burma?
I don't know, maybe in a few decades, yeah.
Because they don't say it's like Sri Lanka, also known as Ceylon.
Yeah, but the politics around it...
Has it got a lot
of politics? Yeah, because it was called Burma by the British.
Yeah.
So that was a colonial name. But then the military junta unilaterally decided to call it Myanmar.
Mm-hmm.
And then so a lot of people, particularly activists and exiled activists, reject the name Myanmar because it was imposed by the military. Which that on its own seems like a reasonable reason to reject the term Myanmar. But then the term Burma also refers to the Burmah population, so it's Burma is actually a bit centric on one ethnic group when there's over 135 ethnic groups.
I see.
So in some ways, Myanmar is actually maybe a bit more of a neutral name. It's not the worst name ever, but the fact that it was unilaterally imposed by the military is problematic.
Yeah. So they're both problematic names, and so that's why we say both of them.
Yes.
So if you say that name, a bit problematic, well, you got the other name.
Yeah, two negatives so make a positive.
It's like some Pong game where you can just bounce between. Okay, I see. But how would you compare... I mean, yeah, there's a lot of ethnic groups in Myanmar, so, yeah. I guess it's... But how would you... I guess it's hard to compare then with Cambodia, which is more so a monocultural... country. Apart from where we are, like now we're in these northeast mountains, so you have these indigenous groups and stuff, but on average, like Cambodia has a relatively similar cultural.
Myanmar's
very got all these, so many groups and
stuff. A lot more different in its ethnic diversity, which is huge, like over 135 groups.
Yeah.
Which make up I think approximately 45% of the population are the non-majority, so it's big diversity. Yeah, and just I guess the ongoing civil war, and particularly in the border areas, and marginalization of those ethnic groups, mm-hmm. is something that's not as common in Cambodia. But Yeah, definitely some similarities in terms of the influence of Buddhism and, you know, strong agricultural sector, a lot of people working in rice production and things like that. So there are certain similarities, but then you do get this fusion much more of South Asian influence as well.
Okay.
And there's a colonial legacy of the UK or Britain as opposed to France. So you have a lot of the Indian and Bangladeshi kind of administrative people that were in Myanmar that have kind of integrated within the broader country as well. So quite a few, and it's a much bigger country as well, so there's a lot of complexities. Yeah,
there's just a lot more happening. And yeah, and then like you talked about, like, so the ongoing sort of civil war, so the last, what is it, like the last month now almost, so like 1st of February is where the current coup started. So COVID and a coup.
Yeah,
same time. So, and you're in contact with a lot of people still there. So, I don't know. How are you feeling about it all? You're, I don't know, feeling pessimistic about it, or you think there's a chance it might end well soon, or you think it's going to be a very extended. Well, you can't say.
I think
no comment.
I think it's impossible for anyone to predict. There's a few different ways it can go, for sure. Like, in some ways it's very inspiring to see the protest movement coming together of a lot of different ethnic groups that were maybe much more divided previously, and the amount of public protest and solidarity and standing up for people's rights is really inspiring and amazing. But then the sheer violence and brutality of the military is horrific, and they killed over 250 people so far. That seems to be escalating. Whether that also triggers broader conflict or armed conflict throughout the country is a real possibility as well. So that's major concern. So how it goes from here, is this the moment that maybe they needed this rupture to really finally push out the military rule, or will the military be able to bring everybody under control again, is really hard to tell. But the people I speak to, nobody is willing to go back to the way things were. I know the international community really brought into this process of reform, and that democratic progress was happening. It was slow, but there was certainly significant progress. But, you know, the military is throughout this democratic transition, which is completely undone now, but they were still waging civil war in the border areas. They committed ethnic cleansing, probably genocide against the Rohingya.
Yeah.
Yet the international community still kind of bought into this idea of democratic transition. But that transition as well, even though Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy, won two elections, they're very ethnic Burma centric. So really a lot of the grievances and representation of ethnic minorities were really unheard. And the current election, the one that happened just recently, also excluded a lot of ethnic areas from voting in the election. So hopefully the current crisis can be resolved in a way that leads to a much more equitable federal system, which is what people are calling for.
But before, the international community didn't care because they were like, at least it's some semblance of democracy and it's relatively stable. So they were like, beggars can't be choosers kind of thing, and were willing to ignore all the other stuff.
Yeah, and a bit of a reformist, like, okay, progress
it's getting
is,
there.
Be,
yeah,
is
yeah,
being
yeah,
made.
Yeah. Baby steps, baby steps.
In certain ways, yeah, definitely. But the flip side of the argument is that Aung San Suu Kyi really didn't have much power, which I think most people accepted, but then that things were very delicate, so she was seen as like ingratiating herself a lot to the military and even defending them at the International Criminal Court against the charges of genocide. And she was criticized a lot for that,
and
I think rightly so. But I also think you can argue the international community, or a lot of analysts, national and international, didn't know how fragile the situation was, which has now kind of been proven. She was walking through a very delicate tightrope, basically.
Tightrope.
So now in retrospect, you can say, okay, maybe she had some justification or at least a logic for why she was doing that.
Yeah.
But, you know, she did all that and still didn't make a difference. So maybe she should have gone down the path of being
gone the whole...
more forthright on human rights and democracy.
But gone the whole
easy 2020 hindsight.
Yeah. And you think the military, so they kind of, after this recent election, they just kind of freaked out because they somehow expected to win more seats, or they just, you know, they were like, okay, this is clearly a threat to us, or, yeah. I still don't understand their mentality for taking such extreme steps in this situation.
Yeah, there's a really good article that I recommend people to read called The Myanmar's Stupid Coup, or The Stupid Coup, by Ae Myin Thant. And it kind of looks at, like, this idea of, like, the logic of the military, that when we apply, you know, external logic of... because they had controlled the country, they could do whatever they wanted with impunity prior to the election, so why would they do a coup? It just doesn't really make sense. If you're profiteering from this opening up of the country, foreign investment, why upset that balance? But it kind of explains this kind of deeply embedded insecurities of the military and the fact that they felt that they were losing some kind of power and really were unafraid to kind of assert their authority in brutal ways as they're kind of showing.
It's like a very Cartman mindset, I don't know.
Yeah. It's great because like the most recent election, like the Aung San Suu Kyi's party won it in a landslide, but the landslide was pretty similar to the landslide election in 2015. So it wasn't like the military lost some seats, but it really didn't have that many seats anyway. So electorally, the difference wasn't that big. Maybe they felt some threat. Also, there's the commander-in-chief was set to retire because he's hitting 65. So how much of him doing a power play so that he can stay in power, how much did he want to become president? Those kind of things play into it as well.
I see.
Yeah, a lot of different dimensions.
But it does seem different that, I mean, Cambodia has had this recent, you know, arguably always been authoritarian since, even since the UN set up its sort of democratic framework in the early 90s. But I feel like there wasn't, even with when they fully stamped out any kind of semblance of democracy, in the last few years, there hasn't been this sort of so much of a youth movement, or as far as I've seen, that's been this active and this obvious. Do you have any reasoning, or do you have any sense of why there hasn't been this mass movement by the youth in Cambodia? Is it because like the parents are still all scared because of the Khmer Rouge and they're just telling them just don't you know, rock the boat, or do you think it's a cultural thing, or I don't know?
Yeah, in comparison to Myanmar, I think Myanmar has definitely had this strong history of political protest and grassroots mobilization, even during the military junta period or re-entry into that period. So you see a lot of that protest emerging very quickly now and the mass mobilization. Cambodia, I think, gave very much this element of post-traumatic stress from the older generation being handed down to the younger generation has definitely had an influence. And also, the kind of idea of grassroots mobilization has not had as strong a recent history in Cambodia. So it has emerged at times, such as the union movement for garment sector workers in the 2000s, but then broader youth movement hasn't really mobilized that much. There's been a few issue-based mobilizations, but not a broader. So there's still some kind of underground youth mobilization going on now.
Yeah.
But at a large scale, it's really difficult. And the government is also hyper aware that mass mobilization is its the greatest threat to its power.
Yeah.
So I kind of view it a lot like the way people are treating COVID. It's like as soon as you have a little cluster of opposition and mobilization, you have to squash it. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the authoritarian mindset. Squash it as quickly as possible. If you see a super spreader, you really need to detain, put that super spreader in jail, because they start sowing these seeds of dissent and mobilization, and it can spread very quickly.
So, I see. This has anyone written this? You need to.
I know. There should be
a book there.
There's a strong parallel between the way.
Just call it super spreader.
Cambodia's suppressed dissent and suppressed COVID for sure.
Get in there before Sebastian writes his next book and does this kind of. The writer of Hun Sen's Cambodia. If you ever want to understand Cambodian politics, just read that as a book.
It's fantastic, very
enlightening.
And a gripping read, even if you don't actually know Cambodia that well. It's fascinating. But I'll just say that, like, there is some really strong youth activists and that are pushing for change. They're just pushing against a very well-oiled authoritarian machine. So
yeah. He's been doing it a while, Hun Sen, the Prime Minister. Because he's still one of the longest-serving Prime Ministers worldwide or something.
Yeah, I think once Mugabe dropped off, I think he took pole position. Yeah. But you see, like, you know, Thailand and Taiwan and Hong Kong's and this Milk Tea Alliance, which is quite exciting.
Hashtag Milk Tea Alliance. Yeah,
which is really cool, and I think some of that is feeding into Myanmar as well, and some of this informal, you know, sharing of protest ideas and things like that.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, if that
can potential
get some legs in Cambodia, but the government's also highly aware that that could seep into Cambodia. So if you look at Thailand and Hong Kong, it's the protest movement's great, the youth mobilization is great, but then it's also been pretty suppressed, heavy-handed.
But social media, and I mean, my understanding, because I think the government set up some kind of authority or something to filter internet content, but it's still, Facebook seems still pretty open in Cambodia, and you can sort of write what you want versus China or something. And then Myanmar, they've, I don't know, has that changed in the last few weeks? Or
yeah, so
Myanmar, they blocked the internet.
So they blocked, like, mobile data internet. They block all internet 1 a.m. till 9 a.m. They've blocked Facebook. They've blocked Twitter. They've blocked WhatsApp. I think maybe even blocked Signal as well. So to access any of those, you need to have VPN access.
Yeah.
They're increasingly telling the telecom companies to, like, stop various VPN systems as well. So it's very, very heavy-handed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even you see, like, as soon as they got rid of the mobile data network, a lot of on the streets protests declined quite significantly. Whether that's because of the internet, it's hard to tell, but it definitely made it riskier because you can't communicate as quickly.
Yeah, I mean, you need to. So, you need to coordinate somehow, and I don't know. Yeah. The walkie-talkies there.
Yeah. Poor Aung San Suu Kyi and 6 walkie-talkies. Could have been all the difference.
Yeah. All right, well, I think that's all we have time for. Yes.
Oh, we've gotten,
We got carried away. This is when two politics nerds sit on a balcony of an eco lodge.
I know.
Time flies.
And you can hear some beautiful Cambodian music in the background.
Yeah, maybe vaguely. It's very traditional Cambodian. We'll go back to eating dried mango and cashew nuts. In the jungle, and thank you again, Dustin.
Thank you for having me here. I look forward to next year.
And yes, Dustin is also, I don't know, like, people to support the Myanmar effort in some
definitely
ways.
If you're thinking of how could you help people in Myanmar, there's a website called isupportmyanmar.org. maybe.com, I think it's .org, and there has a bunch of links where you can donate money, and all of that goes directly to people on the ground. It can help with medical costs for protesters that are getting shot. It can help for food for people that have stopped doing their jobs because of the civil disobedience movement. It can pay for protective equipment for protesters on the streets. It can pay for many different things, and every dollar goes a long way, but the more you give, the more impact it can have. And it is a really critical juncture in Myanmar, so highly recommend whatever support you might be able to give. Isupportmyanmar.org.
Sounds good. All right. Thanks, everyone. See you next month.
Fight for your rights, fight for your life. There's a time for revolution.